Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:37 p.m. and that is Central Time, and today is Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought I would kick off with the S&P 500's PE ratio, because it contracted in the last quarter down to what might even be considered a modest 29.4 level. So historically that's been very high. And particularly when we go back 100 years and look at the peaks. So historically, we've seen that the ratio has seldom been above 25. But all of the occasions on which it has been sustained above 25 have been in the last 30 years. So we have to ask some big questions. Obviously, one of the biggest is, what happened? Has something changed materially about how stocks are valued? And I think there are two important factors. The first is globalization. So we saw that the P/E ratio was at historic lows back in early 1980, and it was similarly low in 1949, and then also in the late 19-teens. And then subsequently, we saw big moves on the upside. And we saw a very lengthy period of the PE ratio rising from 1980 all the way through to that exaggerated peak around the credit crisis, because, of course, earnings evaporated. So the PE ratio went through the roof. So then we had so obviously then that's one big question answered. So obviously we have international earnings, and they weren't nearly as much of a factor in the preceding century. So now most of the big weightings in the S&P 500 are big international companies, and they have significant proportions of their revenue that are sourced around the world. So it's reasonable that the growth rate is higher, and therefore the valuation might be somewhat higher. And that's, I guess, a partial explanation, or at least a rationalization for where the valuation is right now. But, of course, we are also in an environment where interest rates are exceptionally low. So, because the valuation is low, because the valuation is high, but the bond yield is low, then that's also helping to justify a somewhat higher valuation. And particularly when we continue to look at where valuations are relative to government bond yields, well then, that ratio is still rather accommodative. So when people are eager to talk about bubbles, they don't talk about the relative comparisons between asset classes. Because in the real world, when people are making decisions about what they are going to invest in and how they're going to allocate resources in order to protect their own interests and the interests of their clients, well, they're going to be making these relative comparisons. So when bond yields are so very low, then it's not like people like paying for these exceptionally high PE ratios and valuations. It's that they don't really have a lot of choice. And we've seen ample example of that over the course of just this week. So Tesla has been an exceptional performer, and the size of the company has multiplied multiple times, and they've successfully become a center of gravity in the automotive sector, and they're forcing every other one of those companies to moderate or change their business models. So Volkswagen announced this week that they're going to double the amount of money that they're devoting to migrating towards electric vehicles. And it's in the region of about $50 billion. Nissan said that they were going to allocate, I think it was $18 billion. And then GM said that they were going to spend, I think it was $3 billion alone in Michigan to retool for electric vehicles. Now, that kind of spending would have hammered the shares in a previous cycle, because it would have represented a significant hit to the balance sheet. It would have eaten into margins, and this is exactly what happened to Tesla about 10 years ago. They decided they were going to build their first gigafactory. The share peaked, went sideways for 3 years, and didn't break out until they finished building it. So, because we have this low interest rate environment, and what this is in fact doing is helping to support these higher valuations, and it's leveraging balance sheets along the way. And that's exactly what we're seeing in the automotive sector, that the low interest rate and the desire to keep up with the high growth companies is forcing these traditionally more conservative companies who have paid great attention to the integrity of their balance sheets because they're capital-intensive businesses, well, they're now being forced to lever up. So I think it was important to start off looking at the conventional PE ratio, because when we look at the Shiller PE ratio, well, then we're coming in on the highs from 2000. Now, of course, one of the benefits of looking at the Shiller PE is that we have an equal amount of history, and then we have a similar pattern, but the peak to trough swings are more exaggerated in the period from about 1880 through to about 1980. We still have the lows, but we don't have the contraction in valuations this year because it's based on averages. So this is the reason that the PE ratio has contracted in conventional terms is because earnings went up. But because the Shiller PE is taking a 10-year average, then it's moderating the influence. So it's exaggerating in this case. Now, you can also see, for example, in 2000, then it also exaggerated on the upside. So when we start to think then, the Shiller PE, it's obviously a very good measure of by leveling out and smoothing the overall cycle. But at the same time, it's not a timing tool. And I think it's relevant to point this out because I've seen an increasingly large number of well-respected investors talking about bubbly activity. And I think that's relevant. We've definitely seen a significant increase in valuations, and they were pricey before the pandemic, and a lot of the factors that we might look for to predict what a recession or when a recession might evolve were starting to flash orange in 2019. And then, of course, we had the pandemic and it accelerated everything, and valuations didn't really come down all that much. So now we're in a situation where we've had a significant run higher in the stock market, and people are worried. And they're worried because we've seen prices go up so much in the last 18 months, and the Federal Reserve is beginning to talk about tapering and accelerating the taper, and then the stock or the bond market has pretty much priced in 3 interest rate hikes next year. Of course, the Federal Reserve hasn't said anything about raising rates 3 times next year. They have said that the first interest rate hike would likely follow shortly after they'd finished the taper. And they haven't really said anything about raising rates 3 times next year. So this is market expectations because of the higher inflation rate and what might be needed to combat it. But then we can think about, well, yes, there is the potential for bubbly activity, but I think it's also relevant to highlight some of the other factors that are going on that are getting people worried. Well, the first is that the founders of companies seem to be stepping away. So one thing I thought was interesting over the course of the last couple of weeks was that Sequoia Asset Management, or the big private equity, and I guess the most famous of the private equity firms, announced that they're changing their fund structure. So they don't want to be limited to the 10-year time horizon any longer. They want to have an infinite time horizon so that they can benefit from more asset price appreciation in a time frame longer than a decade. So that's obviously they're looking at the initial positions that they had taken. And one of the great things about the base effect is that if you buy at $1 instead of $10 and the price goes from 100 to 200, well, then the multiplication factor is significantly higher. So if you IPO at 100 and it goes to 200, you've given up an awful lot of your portfolio gain if you were the person that bought it at a dollar. And obviously, Sequoia have seen that happen on numerous occasions because they've been instrumental in bringing some of the largest companies in the world to market. But then we can think about the additional fact that we're already 13 years into this bull market, and it's a big one. There's no question of that. And the founders of companies and founder-led companies generally tend to do best because they have their own interests very much aligned with that of the shareholders, and then it's their baby, so they want to make sure that it does the best that it possibly can. And the founders ETF did admirably in the period up from the lows in March, and then it pulled back below the trend mean this week, and or last week, I should say, and then it's been a little bit rocky in here right now. Now, something that we are seeing is that so Sequoia have changed their business model, and then Andreessen and Horowitz, they're beginning to step back from their business. Now, they're still obviously extremely busy people, but they're no longer engaged in the day-to-day management of the company, and they're acting more like the quarterback and coming in and giving advice in a paternal manner to a number of companies. So that's also a change to their business model. So I'm not making a value judgment on whether it's a good or a bad change, but they are changing. Then you have both Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos have got divorced in the last 18 months. And obviously that's a big change too. So at least it represents volatility in one's personal life. At the same time, it also represents a desire for change. So that's something else that we might conclude. And again, it's not a value judgment, it's just simply an observation. Now, we can also look at the fact that Elon Musk is selling shares. And it might be to tackle his tax obligation. And it might also be to raise cash, because we know for a fact that he has been borrowing against his shares. So then he may need additional cash to satisfy some of those debts. Then we also know that from just simple filings that Sergey Brin, Larry Page, Satya Nadella, they're all selling shares as well in the tune to hundreds of millions. So this isn't like they're selling all of their positions, but they're certainly raising some cash. And of course, nobody could really question why they would do that, because the performance of the Fangman shares plus Tesla has been nothing short of incredibly impressive. And the group now has a market cap of 2.1 trillion. Of course, it's also worth reminding ourselves that yesterday it was 12.2 trillion. So it's down 100 billion in here today. Now, this is still a consistent trend on the upside, and the sums that we're talking about are eye-wateringly large. And we've gone from talking about hundreds of millions and billions 20 years ago to talking about hundreds of billions and trillions today. And that's just numbers. And liquidity, and it really is, and this is, of course, the way that the market is interpreting it. It's only numbers. And when we think about the quantity of liquidity that's being printed, then there's nothing to say that it can't continue to move higher. And that's one of the most important factors. Now, one of the things that I think is important to highlight, the first is that yes, valuations are high. Now, let's just simply think about the parallels that we have with the NASDAQ bubble in the late 1990s. So I think one of the nice comparisons is with Cisco. One of the things that I think we need to first look at is what contributed to that bubble, and then how did it and why did it pop? Well, the first thing is we can see clearly that the price to sales ratio for Cisco was chugging along at about 10 for most of the 1990s. And then between 1997 and late 1999 and into early 2000, it went to 60. So we had a profound event happen in 1998 because Russia defaulted on their debt, and then long-term capital management went bust. The Federal Reserve stepped in and did a whip around in the financial sector, and they ensured that the banking sector was insulated. So in doing that, they flooded the market with liquidity. And at the same time, there was this anticipation that there was going to be a problem with Y2K. Everyone thought that all the computers in the world were going to stop working. So we had this massive spend in new infrastructure. And of course, we were in the era of the first wave of the internet going broad spectrum and everybody wanting an internet connection. And this was the motive force behind the decision-making process, that everyone was told, well, you've got the internet, you might not have bought it yet, but you're going to need to buy it at some stage. And by the way, all your computers are going to stop working on the 31st of January, so you might as well buy them now. So we had this incredible flood of orders, and it massively boosted earnings. So then that gave a foundation to the growth forecasts, because it was anticipated that this growth in earnings would continue indefinitely. And of course, by the time we got around to 1999, the Federal Reserve was already raising interest rates. When we got into 2000, everyone who wanted to buy a computer has already bought one. Everyone who wanted to upgrade their network had already done so. And those growth projections faltered. And then interest rates started to bite, and the technology sector pulled back in a very profound manner. And a lot of the leverage was squeezed out of it. A lot of the businesses that were totally liquidity and growth oriented disappeared. Now let's think about where the parallels are today and where are the big differences. I think that there are two important points to make. The first is that the pandemic is a really important event because it forced everyone to pay attention to the cloud. And if everyone had heard of the cloud over most of the last few years and had heard more about off-site servers and having access to all of your data and all of your applications remotely, so you didn't have to sustain the infrastructure, you didn't have to make the capital investment in the servers, you could simply put it all online. And then those companies that were selling you that online space, they'd worry about upgrading their infrastructure. And you no longer had the risk of having antiquated infrastructure that you'd put the capital investment in, and then you didn't want to have to invest again to boost it. And everybody got that exact same sales pitch over most of the last decade. But with the pandemic, then they were forced to make a very significant decision about what to do about it. And everybody, or anyone who wanted to go cloud, went cloud in 2020. So now the big question is, what happens in terms of growth? But obviously, that's a parallel with what happened in the 1990s. But the difference on this occasion is that these are services businesses. So when you're buying infrastructure, infrastructure is a one-off. You go off, you build your network, and you come back in 5 years when you want to upgrade it. Well, today, because you're buying a subscription to that cloud infrastructure, you don't have to put the capital infrastructure, you don't have to put the capital cost up front, but you're paying for it every month. So the companies that are delivering that kind of service, well, they might see their growth start to come back, but they're unlikely to see their revenue evaporate. So that sets them in a different kind of environment. Now, when we think about a company like Cisco, where the price to sales ratio went to 60, and it was also among the largest companies in the world at the time, well, then that was absolutely bubblish. We look at a company like Salesforce, and the price to sales ratio has been up and down between about 12 and 6 for most of the last 15 years. Now, if we can then think about Sun Microsystems, and we may not be able to get the ticker, or we might not get the fundamentals. And unfortunately, it's just not going to come up. But the CEO talked about how the price to sales ratio was a 10 in 1999, and of course Cisco was way higher than that. Well, now let's just think about a company like Tesla, and the price to sales ratio is at 20, and it was at 20 back in 2012 as well. So that's high. There's no question of that. And it's extremely overvalued, and there's no question of that either. But it's not on the same scale of bubblishness that we had in 1999. So then, of course, Tesla is selling the same kind of products that Cisco was. They're selling unique pieces of our unique products, not services. So if there's any of these big companies that's susceptible to this kind of environment, well, it's going to be those like Tesla that fit into the same model as 1999 rather than the software companies. And then, of course, Apple is another company. Now, of course, they have both services and solid products. But the solid products, the phones and the iPads and the MacBooks, they represent the majority of the business. And the price to sales ratio is taking off. So it's now up to 8, and the value of the company is approaching 3 trillion. So that's a really significant advance. And the share is looking overbought in the short term. So we might yet see some pause in consolidation. Now, when we then think about, well, what are the parallels again with 1999? Well, back then interest rates were rising, and right now interest rates are not rising. So we're just not there yet. But are we in the third psychological perception stage of this bull market? Well, yes, we are, because nobody believes that these prices can come back in the same way that they did in 2000 through 2003. Nobody believes that some of these trillion-dollar companies will lose that valuation. So, and then of course there's the TINA argument. In other words, there is no alternative. Well, the reality is that there's always an alternative, but that alternative doesn't become sufficiently attractive until the assets that have been bid up in an aggressive manner become less attractive. So, over the course of this week, I've been talking about both the push and the pull of value stocks, and most particularly emerging markets and commodities. Because obviously, when you've got attractive valuations, then they do become, they do offer the pull factor because they're attractive. But you don't have the push. Because if we look at the relative performance of the eight largest companies, well, this ratio hit a new high in here this week. Now, it pulled back, but it's still got a sequence of higher reaction lows. And nothing has really happened to scare all the boys and girls that are buying these stocks. So we're certainly getting a little consolidation. And there's still a lot of wonder about what's going to happen in terms of interest rates. Now, I'm rather skeptical that the Federal Reserve is going to be able to raise rates three times next year. I have a strong inclination to think that they're probably going to go for one and done. And one and done is what a lot of countries have done. And very few have been able to raise rates more than once. And it's really the emerging markets, which are in fact less levered and have got a more recent history of having to deal with inflationary pressures, that have been more aggressive in raising rates. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we have Japan, which hasn't been able to raise rates in donkey's years. And then we have Europe, which didn't succeed in raising rates at all in the last cycle. So now the big question is, will the Federal Reserve fall into that same trap? And is the and with the yield curve spread starting to come back down, and it certainly helps if you press the right button. Well, the yield curve spread is now at 82 basis points. So this chart has not updated. And it broke down in a big way about 2 weeks ago. So it's looking increasingly likely that the peak at 150 basis points is the peak. And we're not going to see it go all the way up to 300 basis points on this occasion. And if that's the case, well, then the chances are that we're likely to see an inverted yield curve at about in about 2 years' time. And then subsequently, that would be start the clock on a recession at probably in 2024. So one thing that I think is interesting is that friends of mine have been looking at the and Akhil Patel in particular. He's been looking at the 18-year cycle in real estate, and the last peak in real estate was in 2008, and then it generally goes down for 4 years, and then it goes up for so that would take us to 2012, and then it goes up for 7 or 8 years, which takes us to 2020. Then you get a mid-cycle slowdown, 2020. So then you're already at 12 years into the cycle. Then you go up for another six, and that's the end of the cycle, and then you go down again after that. Well, if we have a recession at some point in 2024, that might shorten the cycle. But the reality is that this yield curve spread coming back down is pricing in the potential that financial liquidity is going to start to tighten. And financial conditions are bottoming, and high yield spreads are also bottoming. But this is really just the beginning of a tightening cycle. It's not the end of a tightening cycle. And I think that's the most important fact, that we always have emergency measures after a surprise. And then central banks very gradually start to withdraw their accommodation. And that's what markets are anticipating right now. But of course, we're in a much more interest rate sensitive environment, which inhibits the ability of central banks to raise rates. And the yield curve spread demonstrates that because it's peaked at a lower level. And Because the quantity of debt is so high. Well, if you do some, I guess, back of the napkin calculations, every 100 basis point increase in yields represents $110 billion on top of the cost of servicing the debt. And that's assuming the quantity of debt remains the same. Of course, if the debt rises, well, then the sensitivity to interest rates only increases. And the cost of servicing the debt went down in 2020, even though the size of the debt in most countries went up about 50% in 2020. So in 2021, the cost of servicing the debt went back to close to where it was in 2019. And we're still in an environment where we have exceptionally liquid financial conditions. So these are close to the most easy financial conditions we've ever had at any time in the past. And it's unlikely that they're going to get more easy. So it's really only then a question of how long is it going to take until they become significantly less easy. But that's significantly further down the road. So when people think about bubbles, well, then it's usually the Federal Reserve kills off bull markets. And it's usually the case that people are fully invested by the time the market peaks. And at least from what I can see, there's still a lot of people are still holding a lot of cash. And I keep meeting people who are worried. There's some people who are on, well, what I find is that a lot of retail investors are heavily invested. And institutional investors are much more cautious and raised cash in 2020 and have been very slow to reallocate, despite the fact that markets have rallied significantly. And usually at the top of a bubble, nobody's expressing fear and everybody is fully invested. So financial conditions are still really accommodative. Now, I think the other one, and this used to be much easier to observe, and it's rather difficult to find reliable data these days, but Yardini put out this free report about 2 weeks ago, and it overlays the margin debt and the market cap of the S&P. Now, the most important thing is that when they diverge is when one has to worry. And margin debt continues to march higher. And we can see over the history of this trend that we had a significant peak in margin debt and it pulled back sharply before the market peaked in 2000. And they peaked pretty much together in 2007, and it was trending downwards when the market eventually broke down. And then we had this condition over the course of the last 13 years, where every time it peaked, the market pulled back and then it started to rise again. So we had QE1, QE2, QE3, QE infinity, and now pandemic QE. And on each of these occasions, the margin debt peaked and troughed. And when it troughed, the stock market also troughed. So investors have become conditioned. They believe that any time the market pulls back in a violent manner, the Federal Reserve is going to step in. And since that has been the case on multiple occasions over this decade and in decades past, well, then they have some foundation for that belief. And most importantly, the margin debt is at extraordinarily high levels, but it is still rising. So that's still supporting the stock market overall. Now, when we then think about the Nasdaq, which has been far and away the best performing of the indices, it accelerated in an exceptionally profound manner from 1998 through to 2000. And it did it from a mild pullback. Well, we had a significant pullback in 2020, and the index got all the way down to test the 1,000-day moving average. And we've come close to the 1,000-day moving average on a number of occasions over the course of the last decade. And from 1995 through to 2000, the index didn't really come anywhere close to it. And then it really accelerated in 2000. And by the time it peaked, it was 67% overextended relative to the trend mean. Now, we've had a big move in the Nasdaq over the course of the last year. But at its peak, 3 weeks ago, it was almost 42% overextended relative to the 1,000-day moving average. Now, I think it's important to think about this in terms of short-term, medium-term, and long-term considerations. The short-term consideration is that the market has just bounced from the upper side of the underlying range, and as long as it continues to hold that low, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. So we've had another instance of buying the dip. On the medium term, we can look at the trend up from the low in 2020, and we see the sequence of ranges one above another. And the most recent of those is holding the upper side of the range. These ranges are not dipping down into one another. They're relatively similar sized and they go on for a relatively similar period of time. So as long as the low from last week is holding, well then this is still a consistent trend. And a consistent trend is a trend in motion. So it's likely that it will persist and that we will see this range last for anything up to about 6 or 7 weeks, and then it'll break out. And when it breaks out, the next range should form above the previous peak. So after a breakout, we shouldn't see the price come back below 16,800. And when that sequence changes, well, then that will be an inconsistency. It will tell us that the imbalance between supply and demand that's been animating this market has changed, and that something will then we would then have to start going back and looking at all of the different kinds of things that would contribute to a medium-term peak. So obviously that's something that we would need to be aware of. But so far, it's not really a problematic issue. And of course, then we have the long term. Well, we haven't been this overextended relative to the trend mean in a very long time. So we're in the third psychological perception stage of this bull market. And it's in this stage that we would anticipate that there would be a bubble. And it looks increasingly likely that that's exactly what we're going to have, and that there is a real issue with the ability of the central bank to raise rates. The cost of servicing the debt for the federal government has the potential to cause a recession. So obviously, they're going to have to be exceptionally cautious about raising rates. And obviously, when we look at the news headlines today, the inflation rate came in at levels that haven't been seen since the 1980s. But it's quite normal to see inflation on a year-over-year basis hit new highs when the depression that we had in December of 2020, and or the depressed levels that we had in December of 2020, are taken into account. Of course, as we move forward, what central banks will need to see is a trend of inflation. And trends mean both ebbs and flows, and that you get higher reaction lows, and then you get subsequently continued highs. Now, obviously, there are a number of different moving parts, and the determination of the automotive sector to produce fewer cars and charge more for them is contributing to inflation. And the relative performance of the semiconductor sector is also particularly noteworthy because they are producing some of the most significant pieces of or the most significant products for the global economy anywhere, and the index continues to trend higher, and it's doing so in a consistent manner. And when we look at it relative to the 1,000-day moving average, well, we're quite overextended. And this index has been trending higher for a lengthy period, and it was even more overextended in 2000. So we're in an increasingly likely stage where bubbly activity is forming. And of course, that is being supplemented by the strength of the US dollar. So this is also quite similar to what we had in the late 1990s. You can remember back then the USA, it was one of the only times in its history where they started paying down the debt. And the revenues that were coming in as a result of the boom in the technology sector were incredibly profound. And the dollar had been trending higher for years in advance of the peak in 2001 and 2. Now, of course, obviously, we had 9/11 in 2000, and the USA went on a lengthy period of trying to support the economy because of the shock that it experienced, and the dollar trended lower. And then, of course, there was the multilateral intervention to support the euro. So that also contributed to the weakness of the dollar. And it made US dollar assets less attractive. So in the 1990s, you had both the growth in the US economy, the attraction of the tech sector, and then you had the capital appreciation and currency appreciation from the currency as well. So that was a significant factor in fueling the bubble. And over the last 6 or 7 weeks, the dollar has been resurgent, and it's coming from the lower side of the range, and nothing has really happened yet to suggest that this advance is over. So when people think about where they're going to put their money, they're increasingly putting it into the US dollar denominated assets. Now, I think it's also particularly relevant to pay attention to assets like Bitcoin, because Bitcoin prices have been languishing for most of the last 6 or 7 weeks, and it's just about holding the region of the 200-day moving average right now. This is a bigger pullback than we've seen over the course of the last 6 weeks, and it has dipped down into the underlying range. We've had a little bit of profit taking over the last 2 days, and not least because we had a flash crash last Saturday. So investors are increasingly aware of the potential for volatility during the weekend hours. So there's nobody going to be taking big positions on a Friday when they know what that entails. But then we also had Ethereum, and it's looking increasingly likely that it may close below that psychological 4,000 level. And Ethereum has been particularly strong, and it's been holding its relative performance in an admirable fashion for most of the last month. So it really does need to continue to hold this level if we're going to continue to see the benefit of the doubt being given to the upside. But I think it's relevant to pay attention to what's going on in Bitcoin because it's a magnet for liquidity. And Tesla has been a magnet for liquidity, and it is the company that has done best from the zero or close to zero discount rate that we've had for most of the last decade. And of course, Tesla owns Bitcoin. So if Bitcoin prices break down below the 200-day moving average, and continue their decline because it's a failed upside break. So if it fails at the 200-day moving average, then the potential is it'll come back down and test the 30,000 level. Well, that's going to take a hit out of, it's going to take a chunk out of Tesla's balance sheet, and then that could contribute to a lot of options trading. And Tesla represents about 50% of all options volume. So if Bitcoin pulls back, it'll have a knock-on effect on Tesla. If Tesla pulls back, it'll have a knock-on effect for the options market. If the VIX index goes higher because of volatility in Tesla, well, then it's going to have a knock-on effect for everything. So if we're thinking about where the potential is for strife or for the next reversion to the mean, well, it might not simply be interest rates. It could easily have to do with liquidity and Bitcoin, Tesla, and then the stock market. So Tesla continues to bob around in the $1,000 level, and it's coming off the lows today in much the same manner that Bitcoin has rallied off the lows. So as long as these assets remain reasonably well bid, well, then that's still offering a green light for the wider stock market as well. So ultimately, it's about interest rates, and the 10-year yield remains range bound. So we're in an environment where there's a lot of argument going on, and the range tells us that the arguments are in relative balance. The yield has been going sideways between about 1.2 and 1.8 for nearly 9 months. So there are some people are still very much in the deflationary camp. Others are in the persistent inflationary camp. I tend to think that it is normal that we're going to have a pullback in inflationary pressures next year. Just on a year-over-year basis, it's going to start looking a lot more normal when we start comparing the first quarter of 21 with the first quarter of 22. And as we move forward into 2022, then the comparisons on a month-over-month and year-over-year basis are going to start looking normal again. And inflationary pressures will start to come back down. And that's exactly what we had in 2009 and 10, because it just took that amount of time for just the loopy and exaggerated year-over-year comparisons to iron themselves out. And then, of course, we've listened to the semiconductor conference calls, and they basically say that they're going to have a lot of the problems fixed by the middle of 2022. Of course, Nvidia has deployed a significant amount of revenue and cash to lock down supply, so they could quite easily be oversupplied by the time a lot of infrastructure comes online. And that also helps to highlight that the semiconductor sector is highly cyclical. So we continue to have this big difference in the technology sector, where there are companies that remain extremely cyclical, and those that aren't. And those that have been able to escape cyclicality are the ones that have adopted a subscription business model. Well, there's nobody buying subscriptions to semiconductors. So that suggests that this is still a very cyclical sector. And I think the Federal Reserve is going to wait and see. So they may yet accelerate the pace of their tapering, but they're inhibited from doing very much more than that. And the 5-year yield is certainly the one that is going to be most relevant because it represents the duration of the US dollar debt, and it's now right in the region of 1.25% and in a consistent range, and it looks like it's still an uptrend overall. And every 100 basis points that it rises, it's going to increase the national debt. But the national debt today is pretty much exactly where it was in 2019, when the yields were anywhere from 50 to 75 basis points higher. And $100 billion is more than the USA spends on education or homeland security for that matter. So we're talking about real money if yields continue to rise from here. And that is the kind of thing that will weigh on the dollar and will weigh on the ability of the government to fund itself. And they'll either have to print more money or raise taxes. And considering the tone of the relationship between the left and the right in the USA, that the favorable outcome will be to print more money rather than raise taxes. Nobody wants to raise taxes. And that's equally true everywhere else as well. So European markets trade on a significantly lower valuation, and they've finished with their fiscal austerity regime. And the Euro stocks, or excuse me, Europe stocks 600 is still consolidating in the region of the trend mean from a perspective of a US dollar investor. In local currencies, it's broken out already. When we think about the Japanese market, in local currency terms, it broke out. It's been consolidating for most of the last year. But when we then redenominate that into US dollars, well, it hasn't quite done as well. And it has broken out, and we've had a deeper process of consolidation. But it hasn't pulled away in the same way that it has in nominal terms. And we're now right in the region of the all-time peak. So we're at interesting levels for a number of these markets. When we think about Australia, the domestic market continues to benefit from the devaluation of the currency over the course of the last decade. And from an international perspective, well, then the price is still in the region of the peak from back in 2007. So we can see that there were times when the Australian dollar was very strong and it became extremely attractive for foreign investors. And at the US dollar value of the index went from 1500 to 6000 in the space of about 5 years. So it becomes really advantageous then to invest abroad. And international investors will always look to rebase because they need a relative comparison. They need a benchmark against which to compare. So it's when the dollar rolls over that emerging markets will become more attractive. But commodity prices are certainly doing better. And as we look at what the post-pandemic world is going to look like, well, we've already had the migration to the cloud. That's pretty much done at this stage. And we've also seen that some companies have done exceptionally well from the pandemic. Companies like Zoom Media or Peloton. And they trade on exceptionally high valuations. And when we think about what that means, well, Peloton is it's been killing children. And then you had the Sex and the City episode a couple of days ago, and they killed one of the stars as well. So obviously that's fiction, but it's the kind of thing that gets people thinking. And the company's trading on a price to sales ratio of about 3. But the question, of course, is are they ever going to turn a profit? And a $12 billion company that's selling exercise equipment, and not cheap exercise equipment, well, the chances are that this is a company that could go bust. Well, as we look at what the post-pandemic world is going to look like, every country in the world is talking about infrastructure development. And as we think about financial conditions, well, financial conditions are about as loose as they're going to get in the USA, but they're only beginning to get looser in China. So it's been looking likely for the last 3 months that the credit impulse was bottoming, and we saw greater evidence this week that the credit impulse has bottomed in China. Now, if that's the case, then we're talking about a potentially large quantity of new money coming into the market. China is particularly alert to what they describe as barbarous money flows. Money flows, in other words, that are hot money. And they acted over the last 24 or 36 hours to try and arrest the advance of the currency. And more money went into renminbi assets in the last 20 or 48 hours than we've seen in years. So investors are looking at the stock market and they're looking at the bond market and they're thinking that China doesn't have a choice. They're going to have to provide additional liquidity because they need to do something about the property sector. And when we think about the property sector, well, at least three companies have become bankrupt this week. And the CSI 300 real estate index has been bobbling around at the lower side of a 6-year range for the last 4 or 5 months. And there's certainly the scope that we can see a recovery. The high yield property bond sector has been putting in a higher reaction low. So, despite the fact that China is talking very seriously about the fact that houses are for living in, not for speculating, and they're worried about hot money, and they do not want to have a housing bubble evolve out of what was a very mild correction in housing prices, at the same time, they can't afford for the property sector to go bust. So there's a massive forensic audit going on in the local governments in China right now, and they want to know how big the debts are. And it's going to become a state secret once they know. But we can watch how much liquidity they start putting in. And the more that they put in, the bigger the problem it is. And it's likely to continue to support asset prices in China, in just the same way that liquidity infusions support asset prices elsewhere, which is why foreign investors are moving in because they think that these levels are quite attractive. And we're at the lower side of the ranges rather than hitting new all-time highs. The credit cycle in India has also bottomed, and the number of houses being built continues to increase, and leverage is increasing in the system from a reasonably depressed level, and the RBI is slow to raise interest rates. So the Nifty index is pausing at least in the region of the 200-day moving average and beginning to put in some support. But the Indian rupee has now broken down. So we're seeing that the Nifty is finding support because the currency is weak. And we probably need to see some question about what is India going to do about the fiscal situation in order to stabilize the currency. And it's usually when the currency starts to stabilize that we get our international investors get attractive buying opportunities in India. Then if we think about the global commodities sector, well, we had the big climate conference in Glasgow last month, and there's a real intention to spend an enormous amount of money on reorienting the global energy sector. And that's beneficial for copper, and copper prices continue to hold the region of the trend mean, even though they were weaker in here today. But as long as it's holding the region of the trend mean and eventually breaks out, this is a secular bull market because we see supply inelasticity. It takes years to build new copper mines, and we have new sources of demand from the automotive sector because every one of those automotive companies is going to be investing billions, And if you start adding it together, hundreds of billions on new battery infrastructure. And that means that there'll be new recharging facilities. And of course, it also means there's going to have to be a massive increase in electricity generating capacity. So lots of new power stations as well. And lithium and battery technology sectors are bouncing from the region of the upper side of the underlying trading range right now. And then if we think about some of the steel producers, well, China's steel output has probably bottomed, and the stock, for example, like ArcelorMittal, is starting to demonstrate some support in the region of the trend mean. Iron ore prices, which had been exceptionally volatile, both surging and then retreating, and now beginning to demonstrate support. Well, it's unlikely that the price is ever really going to sustain a move back below 100, because we're looking at a global infrastructure build. So China is going to certainly moderate the pace with which it's been building infrastructure, but infrastructure is needed everywhere else. So this is going to be used as an opportunity to build out a lot more energy infrastructure. And I remain of the view that uranium should have a solid place within that, and the uranium ETF is bouncing this week from the region of the trend mean. I think it's a logical inconsistency that if you really believe the climate's going to change, that you would build energy infrastructure that depends on the climate. So we saw ample evidence of it in the UK already this year, where the wind stopped blowing at exactly the time when it was needed most. And when you think about the climate alarmists, which are being listened to justify this massive energy infrastructure change, well, then there's a threat to the Gulf Stream, which is basically the source of all the wind that West Europe gets. So if that ever starts to moderate, well, then all of that infrastructure that's been deployed into wind will be absolutely useless. But then you can think about the fact that Bill Gates's is it NuScale has got construction contracts with about half a dozen different countries to build small modular reactors. And they're building the first one right now. And they anticipate that once it's up and running, so the NOC cost, so it's not the cost to produce the first one, but to produce them on an ongoing basis, is about 60% less than a conventional uranium-fired power station. And that's something that is really a game changer, because we can think about the innovation that occurred in lift and in the space sector. The invention of reusable rockets has massively decreased the cost of lift, and then the technological innovation in terms of nanosatellites means that constellations of satellites can be launched in with a very attractive price. Well, that's revolutionizing the space sector. And there's the potential that small modular reactors could do the same thing for the uranium sector. And with Generation 4 technology, they're safer. And because there's no proliferation risk, then they can be exported around the world. So there's the real potential that we're going to see a lot more reactors built, and that the cost will be lower, and that this will contribute to a more attractive base load environment. Then we can think about natural gas, because it's becoming a more fungible global commodity. So then it's certainly going to be traded more. Now, the front month contract has almost pulled back in as violent a manner as anything else we've seen this year after a big advance. But it is beginning to find support, and a good reason for it finding support is because European natural gas prices are also starting to rebound. So Europe finds itself in an energy desert. A lot of the infrastructure they've built for renewable energy isn't really worth anything until you have reliable base load. And they decided they were going to go on, or they were not going to sign fixed term contracts and fixed price contracts with Russia, and now they're being shown what that really means. So the US natural gas price is reasonably low. The European gas price is high. It's going to increase the potential for significant shipments to come out of the US, and that should help to support prices. And as we think about the oil price, well, I think we're in an environment where there's a lot of enthusiasm about the global economy and what it might mean for all this liquidity that's going to get poured into the energy infrastructure sector. And it's going to require a lot of oil to get it done. Ultimately, oil as a transportation fuel is going to start feeling the pinch in about 5 years from now. But we're just not there yet. And when we listen to the broad energy sector, they've pretty much stopped investing in new supply. So that's going to support their share prices in the near term because they're going to be exceptionally cash rich. And the energy sector continues to push higher. Well, when we start adding all of these things together, it's pointing towards a commodity bull market. And lumber prices continue to march higher. And there's the invention of the mass lumber sector. Well, what it basically means is that commercial real estate is looking more at the lumber sector because they want to try and avoid the cost of carbon credits related to cement and to steel. So they're going to start building with timber. And of course, that's going to withdraw supply from the home construction sector. It's going to also create supply inelasticity. And nobody's really thinking about the potential now that there's going to be more trees cut down than can be planted, or that trees take time to mature. But and again, what I think we're seeing increasingly is this. On the one hand, you have greenwashing in the ESG sector, but you have sophistry being deployed as well. People saying that the most effective use of trees is not to let them grow in the ground, but to cut them down and use them rather than using steel or cement, and that you can always plant new trees. But of course, they never talk about the time interval. Or they never talk about what is effectively a discount rate, because in this world there isn't a discount rate. But nonetheless, people will find a way around paying significantly higher costs for carbon. And it means that new bull markets will evolve. And the carbon credit market surged higher on Wednesday, pulled back yesterday, and then started moving higher again in here today. And the most important thing is that we're approaching the 100 euro level. And this is where European politicians want it. They want carbon to be around 100 euros because they want to try and seed a new hydrogen bull market. So this is very similar to the origin of the solar market, that there were subsidies in place to try and create manufacturing capacity. And this carbon emissions price is also going to act as a subsidy to ensure demand for hydrogen from the various companies. So these types of instrument, they should start to find support reasonably soon as carbon starts to move and to hold these very high levels. And Fortescue Metals in Australia have been talking about building one of the truly largest and most ambitious carbon production facilities anywhere, and they're basically talking to any government who will listen to them. So they were looking to do it in Western Australia, and I don't know whether they were able to get the planning for it, so now they're talking about doing the same thing in Argentina, and who knows, they might just do both. So the share continues to trade like an iron ore miner, and as the iron ore price starts to find support, well, Fortescue is also finding support. So basically what you're also getting is you're getting the hydrogen sector as an option, and you don't really have to pay anything for it. And the price is firming from the 1,000-day moving average, and I think a lot of people will be a lot happier if it can push back up through the 200-day moving average. So we're certainly in a big bull market environment, and we're seeing the beginning of a transition. So I started off and spent a lot of time talking about the reality of very high valuations on Wall Street. But the dollar is still strong, financial conditions are still easy, the Federal Reserve is inhibited from raising rates because of the negative impact that would have on government finances, and the kind of tough decisions that would be imposed on the polity, which nobody has any appetite for. So that's likely to continue to support the bull market overall. And it's not until we start to see an inverted yield curve or high yield spreads back above or at least approaching 500 basis points, or a number of the other kinds of factors that we might look at would be the OIS spread starting to move higher, the significant underperformance of banks, margin debt starting to trend downwards. So there's lots of things that we could look at for lead indicators. Then none of them, as of yet, are looking to be particularly troubling. So we certainly have the pull from the commodity markets, and we have the pull from the emerging markets, and the rise of the global consumer and the demand from places like India for a higher living standard, and literally billions of young people striving for a better standard of living is going to seed bull markets. So there's lots of pull factors to encourage investors to invest. But in order to have the push factor, the dollar will have to roll over. And when the dollar does roll over, well, then the liquidity-dependent sectors that continue to advance, well, they'll be less easy to justify. So then they would also begin to roll over. And I think that we're not going to see this bull market on Wall Street end until the 8 Fangman plus Tesla shares start underperforming the NYSE. And it's just not happening yet. So with that, I think I will leave you for today, and I'll wish a good weekend to all of you.